Welcome to this podcast from the Medical Journal of Australia. My name is Sam Hunt, the MJA's news and online editor. Today we are discussing new research into voluntary assisted dying in the state of Victoria. The research examines both the barriers to voluntary assisted dying in the state and also looks at what supports are working well. My special guests are Professor Ben White, the Professor of End-of-Life Law and Regulation, and Ruthie Jeanneret, a PhD student. Both are at the Australian Centre for Health Law Research at the Queensland University of Technology. Professor White, Ben, and Ruthie, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Sam. Good to be here.
Yeah, thanks, Sam. Great to be here.
Professor White, if I could start with you. Your research, just published in the Medical Journal of Australia, examines the ways to access voluntary assisted dying and the barriers to that access. Can you tell me a little bit more about what questions you set out to answer with this research?
Sam, our overall goal with this research is to think about how best to regulate voluntary assisted dying. So this paper, which is published in the MJA, is part of a wider four-year study looking at regulation of voluntary assisted dying in Australia, Canada and Belgium. And the overall goal of that is how best to regulate assisted dying to make sure that it's safe, but also accessible for patients. And one of the key bits of evidence that was missing to date was that patient experience. How do patients experience the process of seeking voluntary assisted dying? What are the things that support access to assisted dying? What are the things that hinder that? So Ruthie and I did some interviews with family caregivers and a patient to try and understand that patient perspective. And we did this work with our colleagues, Lindy Wilmot and Eliana Close.
And Ruthie, I'll go to you now. Let's talk about the barriers. At a high level, what were those barriers that you found?
So we identified five key barriers to accessing voluntary assisted dying in this study. So the first one was a difficulty finding doctors, and participants explained that was particularly difficult in terms of finding the first doctor or coordinating medical practitioner to help them through the process. The second barrier was the time that it actually took to get through the entirety of the application process. So there are many different steps that need to be completed, and the requirement that patients be to be eligible very close to death, i.e. within 6 or 12 months, sort of compounded that race against time to access or to get through the process. The third was the telehealth prohibition. So there's an inability to use telehealth for VAD consultations, which means that everything has to occur in person. The fourth is institutional objection. So institutions like hospitals or aged care facilities not allowing some aspects of the process or any aspects of the process to occur on the facility. And the fifth and final one that I'll mention is a prohibition on health practitioners initiating discussions about assisted dying. So this means that patients need to know about it and to raise it themselves. And participants described finding that sometimes those were very awkward or contorted conversations and that they had difficulty finding the right words to say to properly raise it.
Ruthie, these are considerable barriers. Why is there such difficulty finding doctors to assess eligibility for voluntary assisted dying?
There are a few key reasons why there is a difficulty finding doctors that participants reported in our study. The first one that I'll mention is that one doctor has to be a specialist in the patient's or the applicant's condition. So, for example, if you've got motor neuron disease, you'll have to find a neurologist to assess eligibility as one of those two practitioners. And just as an example, one participant actually spoke of contacting several dozen neurologists before they were able to find somebody who could assess eligibility. So that's pretty significant. The second one that I'll mention is that the Voluntary Assisted Dying Act protects conscientious objection, which means that doctors may choose not to participate in the process. And many of our participants reported that they did encounter conscientious objection, and that might be particularly difficult where the doctor might not refer the person to somebody else who might be able to assist them or who might be willing to assist them to go through the process. Sometimes doctors might not have a conscientious objection, but they might just be apprehensive or unwilling or not sure about the nature of their involvement or whether they wanted to be involved. So that was a third reason that patients mentioned that it was difficult to find somebody. And the final one that I'll mention is that doctors must complete the mandatory voluntary assisted dying training. And I'll just flag that was designed by the QUT team led by Professors Ben White and Lindy Wilmot and Patsy Yates, as well as a broader team project manager Kat Waller. And so practitioners must actually complete that training in order to provide VAD. And that might take a day or so, and they have to complete an assessment component. So not all practitioners had completed that or were willing to complete that necessarily. So all those four barriers that I've just mentioned were particularly complex or difficult to navigate, especially when the system was new and where there might not be a list or resources about which doctors might participate and those who would not.
And Professor White, I'll go to you now. What are the difficulties for doctors here in terms of not being able to raise the topic with their patients?
So one of the key barriers that Ruthie mentioned was the inability of doctors to raise the topic of voluntary assisted dying. So maybe I should just quickly state what the law says on this. The Victorian law is very unusual for voluntary assisted dying in that the suggestion that the topic of voluntary assisted dying can only be raised by the patient. A doctor cannot raise it with their patients or suggest this as something for them to consider. The goal here was to deal with coercion or potential undue influence. But this is a very, very unusual law. There are not other areas of medical practice where a lawful choice, a lawful option for a patient can't be raised by their doctor. It's also unique internationally. So South Australia and New Zealand actually copied the Victorian law. But until that time, that this provision also didn't exist in voluntary assisted dying laws internationally. So it is a very unusual law. And in some research we actually did with doctors, which was published by the Medical Journal of Australia in 2021, this was one of the top three regulatory barriers that doctors involved in providing voluntary assisted dying identified. They were concerned about legal risk. How do I know if this has been raised properly? And they also expressed concerns that they might be talking to a patient for whom voluntary assisted dying might be an appropriate option to discuss, but they couldn't. And this is reflected also in the research that we did looking at that patient experience. Participants identified a number of problems with this very unusual law for accessing voluntary assisted dying. Our participants all described patients who were able to access or were able to engage with the voluntary assisted dying process. So they all knew that they had to raise it, but they expressed concerns that just because they knew, what about other people in the community? If you didn't know you had to raise it, you might be sitting there having a conversation with your doctor and thinking, well, I know about this voluntary assisted dying, but why isn't my doctor talking to me about it? So that was one of the problems that they described. It's also difficult to raise in practice. These are difficult conversations to say to your doctor, I'd like to talk about voluntary assisted dying. You don't know what their view might be. Doctors, as Ruthie mentioned, have the ability to object on conscientious grounds, and the legislation protects that. So not sure of what the reception's going to be, and it's just a difficult topic to raise. So participants spoke about how hard that was. And the third issue was, picking up on what Ruthie said, was this idea of finding, inverted commas, the right words. How do I, as a patient, say to my doctor in a way that they clearly know I want voluntary assisted dying? And so participants reported awkward, convoluted, difficult conversations where they're trying to find the right words or the magic words so the doctor can go, aha, you're talking about voluntary assisted dying. So that was one of the key challenges, being able to find those magic words. And indeed, one participant described their loved one raising it time and time again with doctors, but it wasn't recognised as a request for voluntary assisted dying. And it wasn't until they were absolutely obvious and explicit that the doctor was able to say, I think I know what you're talking about now. Would you like to discuss voluntary assisted dying? So this is an unusual law and a problematic one for both for doctors and for patients.
Yes, it does sound like an unusual law. Ruthie, I'd like to go to you now and ask you about telehealth consultations. Can you explain to our audience why telehealth consultations are banned for voluntary assisted dying consultations? And what's the impact of that?
This issue stems from how Australia's legal system is set up in terms of the Commonwealth can make some laws and the states can make other laws. So there is a Commonwealth law contained in the Commonwealth Criminal Code that essentially prohibits a carriage service, so forms of internet or telephone, i.e. telehealth, from being used to do a couple of things. And one of those is to counsel or incite suicide or attempted suicide. And the other is to provide or promote instruction instructions about a method of committing suicide. So the Commonwealth Law was introduced a long time ago. In 2005, those amendments were made, and they were targeted at sort of internet chat rooms where suicide was being discussed. And then since then, the states have legalised voluntary assisted dying. Unfortunately, though, even though each state law has sort of said voluntary assisted dying is not suicide, it's different from it, the state law can't really impact or affect how that Commonwealth law is interpreted. And I will just flag here that our colleagues, led by Eliana Close, have written an article that was published by the Medical Journal of Australia on this topic, so that may be of interest. But essentially, that results in a real risk that if clinicians use telehealth to conduct assisted dying consultations, they may be breaching that Commonwealth law and committing a crime. So each state has taken a different approach to how it manages that. And in Victoria, the Department of Health has issued a policy which essentially places a blanket prohibition on clinicians using telehealth to conduct assisted dying consultations. So that means everything has to occur in person. That's really difficult. It's difficult particularly for regional patients who might not have any doctors in their area, who have to travel hours to find a doctor in a metropolitan region, and they have to then travel home, and then they have to maybe do that again. So that's really, really complex. It has a pretty significant impact both on patients and families in terms of the distress that causes of having to travel, and clinicians who might find themselves wanting to support a patient but then being at risk of committing a crime if they use telehealth to do that.
And Ruthie, the application process as well can be quite lengthy. What kind of emotional impact does that have on people?
Just in terms of a very brief overview of the process, it involves multiple requests and then multiple assessments by various doctors. So there are lots of steps to go through. And in Victoria, it also includes a permit having to be issued before a person can actually take the medication or before it can be administered. So in our study, people describe that the length of the application process had absolutely had an emotional impact in terms of people feeling like they were worried that they might miss out because they might not be able to get through all of those steps before they either lost capacity or perhaps died or lost the ability to communicate. I think people use the words like it felt like there was just always another mountain to climb over or another hurdle to jump over, and they felt like they couldn't get there. So if a person is having to do that, particularly at the end of their life, that has a significant emotional impact on them. And one thing that participants really talked about was the feeling like time kind of warps during the voluntary assisted dying process. It might sound like adding a day's time isn't that much, but actually for people who are going through this, every day felt like a month. So every day was pretty important, and sort of delaying that suffering had a very significant emotional impact on patients and families.
My special guests today are Professor Ben White, Professor of End-of-Life Law and Regulation, and Ruthie Jeanneret, a PhD candidate, both at the Australian Centre for Health Law Research at the Queensland University of Technology. Ben, as Professor of End-of-Life Law, were you surprised at the number of barriers, the red tape that you found?
We weren't surprised by the number of barriers that we did find, because we've done some previous research with doctors which did talk about this challenge. There's probably three things I'd say that were new and significant here. One was a new finding about institutional objection. So this is where healthcare entities, aged care facilities, hospitals, palliative care units effectively don't allow some or all of the voluntary assisted dying process to occur on their premises. This was a new finding, didn't emerge from the research that we did earlier with doctors, but this was really significant. In fact, 17 of the 28 patient experiences included some form of institutional objection, and often it was, you can't do eligibility assessments on site, you're not able to receive the medication or indeed take the medication on site. And some really significant harms to patients came from this. There was delays in the process. Ruthie's already spoken about how that time is of the essence. So there's delays to seeking through the process of voluntary assisted dying. They also spoke about transfers, having to leave your so-called home to access voluntary assisted dying. A key one was having to choose between optimal treatment and voluntary assisted dying. So if the best place for me to receive palliative care because they're good at managing my pain and symptoms, or the best place to manage my illness because I go to hospital X because that's the best place for my illness, But they don't allow voluntary assisted dying. So patients have to choose optimal treatment or pursuing their VAD path. They also spoke about the frustration, the anger, the emotional suffering that went with having to deal with institutional objection. And the last issue was one participant spoke about distrust. Can I trust the clinical advice I'm getting from this institution? They've said I can't have voluntary assisted dying, and now the advice seems to be to do X, Y, and Z, but is that really the best thing for me, or is this being coloured by the institution's position? So this was a really significant finding, and we have recommended in the paper that regulation is needed to address this. Government policy at the moment doesn't really require action on the part of institutions, and we think that should occur. Alternatively, and the optimal outcome actually would be legislation. Queensland, South Australia, New South Wales all have legislation to regulate that. So that was one, I think, of the surprising findings that came out of this. Another was to see the change in findings over time from our doctor's research to our research about the patient experience. It seems that the process of accessing voluntary assisted dying has got smoother over time. We might expect this. Systems get better. Systems evolve over time. And that sort of 18 months, 2 years between when we did these interviews, patients did describe it was difficult to access voluntary assisted dying, to connect with the system. But once they did, that process moved quite smoothly. So that was a significant new learning from this work. And the last point probably to make is one of the things that we, when the assisted dying laws were being implemented, we wrote a paper in the MJA in 2019 saying, this is a complex system. That complexity must be facing inward. It must be facing away from patients. And that seems to be the case where we've landed now. The doctor's experience described a lot of bureaucracy, a lot of process, and I know that's improved over time, but it seems that patients, the way the system's been designed and implemented, patients have been shielded from some of that system complexity in terms of how it's been developed and evolved.
And Professor White, let's turn to the recommendations. What does the research call for the state government to do?
This research has demonstrated that there are significant harms to patients from institutional objection. At the moment, that isn't really regulated in a robust way. There's some policy from the Victorian government, but it's not binding. It doesn't require institutions to do anything particular. And where you have those power asymmetries between a terminally ill patient who's seeking voluntary assisted dying and an institution, better and stronger regulation is needed to achieve that. We think the optimal approach would be to have legislation which regulates that process, which sets out how institutions' views on voluntary assisted dying can be respected, but not at the cost of access for patients. And legislation has been enacted in Queensland, South Australia and New South Wales. So there are existing models to choose from. We think that stronger policy direction is needed from the Victorian government so that patient access to voluntary assisted dying is not impeded in the way that was described by patients, that institutional objection doesn't mean that patients have to go through the harms, the delays and the transfers that are required.
Let's turn the conversation to what's working well in this space. You mentioned that since you started your research and as your research went on, people reported that there were instances of fewer barriers.
Yes, Sam, it is important to note that, yes, we've spoken a lot about the barriers, but there were a lot of important facilitators that patients really appreciated that made their voluntary assisted dying journey possible. One you've already mentioned, and that was system flow. So there were some challenges, especially in the early days, and there sometimes were still challenges in connecting with the voluntary assisted dying system. But once people had made that connection, they reported that the system flowed well, they were well supported, and able to navigate through that. So that was one of the facilitators. The other three are important roles within the system. So the first is the voluntary assisted dying care navigators. These are state-funded health professionals who are based at Peter Mac, but there's a regional presence in all five of Victoria's regional health areas. And their role is basically to assist patients understand the system and help them through it. And this is particularly the case at the beginning of the process where they weren't sure where to go or what to do or how to find a doctor. Those navigators, coordinating doctors, was the second facilitator that was the patients mentioned. They really took the load of that bureaucracy and managing that process so patients were able to be supported through it. It did depend, of course, on luck. As Ruthie mentioned, sometimes you went from doctor to doctor to doctor. But once you found a coordinating doctor, that made a huge impact on facilitating patients through the process. And the third role that made a difference in terms of facilitators was the statewide pharmacy service. Their role is focused really on the education and provision of the VAD medication and how to use it. But participants spoke very highly about the work that they did, the confidence it gave them to understand what they had to do and how to do it.
Professor Ben White and Ruthie Jeanneret, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Sam.
Thank you.
Professor Ben White is the Professor of End-of-Life Law and Regulation, and Ruthie Jeanneret is a PhD student. They're both at the Australian Centre for Health Law Research at the Queensland University of Technology. You can find more podcasts from the Medical Journal of Australia on our website at mja.com.au or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for listening.